Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema. What?
It's funny when you say it like that. A podcast of the cinema.
Well, I'm not trying to be super NPR about it. I mean, it's not like
it's
I'm saying
weird.
Your
delivery is weird.
It would be this: a podcast of the cinema. Because now everyone has to talk like Ira Glass.
I've never felt that need.
I'm talking about everybody on NPR, though, and certain podcasts that I think aspire to be NPR-ish.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean,
this week on the program.
No, I get it. I know.
You're Dave White, of many Dave White things, and I'm Alonzo Duralde of The Rap.
I'm of The Rap, too.
And
you can say that I'm Dave White
that's
of The Rap.
That's true. This week, you are all
this
over
week,
The Rap.
This week, I'm two times of The Rap.
Mm-hmm. You're once, rap. Twice... Two times the rap.
Two times the rap this week.
And I'm on What the Flick, which you are going to be on this coming week in my absence. You got boffo response your first time out.
Right.
I don't know why you're so coquettish about it now.
Because I'm a coquette.
You are a coquette. Go make me some croquettes, coquette.
I'm a coquette. I'm a gamine. I'm a
veritable will-o'-the-wisp. An ingenue herself.
I feel ridiculous on What the Flick. And that's, now that I'm not like panicked about the very thought of going on What the Flick, mm-hmm. now that I've been on What the Flick,
uh-huh.
I just feel goofy being on What the Flick.
It'll be fun.
It turned out to be really fun the last time.
Yeah.
What did I review with Christy? The Fifth Wave.
And this week, you get to talk about Independence Day Resurgence.
And whatever else opens this coming week, I forget.
BFG and...
Was that this week?
Yeah.
BFG?
Next week. Next week
what
is going to be...
think about that movie?
BFG and something else that I think we've already seen.
I have to come up with an opinion about that.
I guess you better. But you'll be great. It'll be fine.
It's been over a week since I've seen that film, and now I don't remember what I think. It was fine.
Yeah,
it was fine.
We will talk about it on the show that we're pre-taping for my absence. So.
Right, that's today. No,
tomorrow.
Today is this.
Today is what we're doing right
tomorrow
now.
Tomorrow is next week's
correct.
Show, where we will talk about a couple of the movies that are coming out next week.
Mm-hmm. And then we will also spoil.
And then we're going to spoil things.
Yes, and read a lot of letters.
What are we spoiling?
Midnight Special and The Invitation.
And Tickled.
Oh, and Tickled,
and
yes.
Tickled.
And Tickled, right.
Yeah. So, then next weekend, I don't have to do anything.
That's right.
It's 4th of July weekend. I get to have a vacation.
Woo!
Well, you're off in the Czech Republic.
Correct.
I'm going to party. I'm going to party down.
You're going to go what? Buy red, white, and blue Twinkies or something?
I'm going to get turnt.
No, you're not. You will do no such thing. Not because I'm admonishing you not to. I just know that you won't.
I just wanted to say turnt.
That was the title they went to after Adam Jones.
Yes.
Right. No.
All right. So let's first get the thing that you saw out of the way.
Ah.
Because I haven't seen it yet. I have to go sometime this week. During the like a morning and crank it out.
Independence Day Resurgence.
Because whatever.
So great that Fox did not show it to the press.
Why?
I have
a personal theory.
Sure. Well, let
you
me
can tell you.
I mean, having seen the movie, I get it, but I mean, I've seen worse this year. I think they got burned on X-Men Apocalypse. Because they showed that super early.
Right.
And I think they thought that that was going to get good reviews. It did not.
Oh, that's right.
And I think also they looked at what happened.
Did anybody go see X-Men Apocalypse?
It did not do great.
Did it make any money?
I don't think so. I mean, probably. I think all the big dumb movies this year are making all their money overseas. And I was going to say, the other example being Warcraft also got screened for critics early because it opened in Europe and China early.
Maybe if I put my headphones on, I'll be able to hear things better.
That could work, sure.
I'm sitting here with no headphones on, wondering why everything sounds weird.
Wow, you know, one would think you hadn't done this show for 5.5 years and knew how it worked.
Listen, every day is new to me.
You are memento. That explains all the Polaroids and the tattoos.
Right. All of my tattoos.
All of your tattoos.
Yeah.
So I think the studio was a little gun shy about showing it to the press, figuring, fairly rightly so, that this was not going to be a critics-driven movie anyway. I want to preface by reminding people that I really, really, really like White House Down.
Okay.
Like, I am not averse to the big, dopey Roland Emmerich disaster spectacle.
No, I understand.
And I even
I'm the same.
I even went back and rewatched Independence Day this week because I had not seen it in 20 years. We went, I think, opening weekend, like the rest of America.
We did.
And I never saw it again. I didn't see it again in the theater.
So the United Artists 8.
Yes, the movie mall.
In North Dallas, in what we used to call it the movie mall. Yeah.
Because it had these big escalators that you had, like the box office was downstairs with a bunch of stores and restaurants that never stayed open.
Yeah, there were never any other businesses that stuck around in that mall.
Well, I remember when they first opened.
It was like a little contained kind of like 30 shops kind of place.
When they first opened, there was like a nightclub downstairs.
Oh, yeah.
And the first weekend they figured out that the music from the nightclub was bleeding into the theater. So they had to like kick them out.
Yeah.
But everything, like, there was like a Chinese restaurant, there was a laser tag, like all these different things, nothing ever lasted in that building, and eventually they shut it down.
But let me tell you, that place was the movie theater to go to in the summer.
Oh.
And the reason why was because Dallas becomes 127 degrees.
Yes.
For 3 solid months.
Yes.
With no break.
No. So we went to the movies a lot.
And even though everyone lives with air conditioning there, and so did we.
Yeah.
The air conditioning at the UA 8 was a very special kind of frozen.
Yeah, like you were sitting next to hanging raw meat.
Yeah. Oh, it was so good. Like, I would see people go in with, like, hoodies, sweaters. This is July in Dallas, Texas. And it never, no one ever complained about it being too cold in there. I think they were simply happy to feel bundled up.
Sure, yeah. No, I remember.
I would go wearing shorts, and when I came out, my skin.
You had chilblains?
My skin would be cold to the touch, and I would get in my hot car and think,
I'm melting.
Weird. This is such a weird feeling. This hot car is not bothering me.
No, I remember when I took a summer film class in Boston, which gets like just severely hot. And I would have to take a sweatshirt to class because it was in the basement of this building and it got so cold in there that I would fall asleep because it was just so comfortable. And I had to bundle a little and not get super frozen or otherwise.
That's how people die in the snow.
Totally, exactly.
They're like, oh, this is so.
Yeah, so we saw the first one. We saw the first Independence Day at the movie mall, and then I never felt the need to revisit it. I enjoyed it. I had a good time. I thought well on it, but never went back.
Right.
So I looked at it again this week, and it's a dumb movie. But I think what Emmerich and Dean Devlin, the writer, very shrewdly do. Is they weld together an Irwin Allen disaster movie.
Yes.
A 1950s creature feature.
Yes.
And a war movie.
Yeah.
All with sort of state-of-the-art special effects.
And Miss Vivica Fox.
And in that movie, we were not used to... I think that movie kind of started the destruction porn wave. Like, you can, if you look back at old movies like Earth versus the Flying Saucer, yeah, they would knock over some landmarks, you know.
Right.
A spaceship would shear off the top of the Washington Monument or whatever. But, like, Independence Day really full on, like, just let's blow up the Empire State Building and the White House and, you know, like, a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny, because in that sort of thing, in contemporary movies, we often attribute as being kind of a post-9/11 mindset. But no, this was 1996, so they were ahead of the curve on that one. So 20 years later, we get this sequel to a movie that, you know, is regarded fondly, but nobody was sort of dying to find out what happened next. And it's just so, like, there's five writers, and there are so many logic holes. Like, you can't think about this movie for a second.
Okay, well, I wasn't planning on
that. I mean, the premise is that, you know, that Earth, 20 years after the events of the first film, is significantly different because we'd gained all this advanced technology from the aliens. So it changed everything from, like, weapons to, you know, air travel to even moon travel. Like, we could send these sort of fighter jets to the moon. And so there's a base on the moon now that's run by the Chinese. And yet we're caught completely unaware when the aliens come back in a ship that is so enormous. It's something like 3,000 miles across. Like, it looks like a hat on the Earth. And it hovers above the Earth seemingly without disrupting any weather patterns whatsoever.
So it's a ship that goes from coast to coast of the United States.
Basically, yeah. It's insane.
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can only see it from space. It's insane. But they don't do anything with that. And they wind, you know, what happens is, like, it manages to suck up Asia and drop it on England. You know, so, like, you see the, you know, like, the skyscrapers from, you know, Kuala Lumpur or whatever come crashing into, like, you know, the eye of London.
Well, that's appropriate.
But then,
for this week.
Indeed. But they just, you know, you've got all these new characters. Margaret Collin, by the way, nowhere to be found, never mentioned, never discussed. She was Jeff Goldblum's estranged wife in the first movie, who gets him into the White House because she's, like, the chief of staff or something, and she's the one who, like, she is his conduit to get in and tell them what's actually going on. Gone. Not here, neither present nor accounted for. Instead, he has this sort of tacked on romance with, of all people, Charlotte Gainsbourg.
That's the only reason that I'm probably going to go see
well,
this film.
She's in it only slightly more than Juliette Binoche was in Godzilla, so don't get your hopes too high. She does pop up, which is just, it's hilarious. Like, the thought of her having to say this dopey dialogue and, like, go to the moon, I'm like, she's thinking, I'm better than this.
You know what she's thinking about?
Yeah, the villa that she's buying with
that's
the money.
That's right.
So you know, Bill Pullman pops up and Jeff Goldblum and Judd Hirsch and stuff. But for the most part, it's about the kids. Like, Mae Whitman has now grown up to be Micah Monroe from It Follows, and she's terrible.
Mae Whitman is not in
Mae
this
Whitman
film.
Is not in it. Micah Monroe is now playing, because apparently Mae Whitman isn't hot enough in a flight suit the way Micah Monroe is. I don't know. Or maybe she told them to F off. I don't know why Mae Whitman's not in this movie.
I hope that's
but
what
she is
did.
Not. And then you have this actor whose last name is Usher, but I don't think he's related. Usher's name is not Usher.
Usher's name is Usher, but it's his first name.
Oh, that's right. It's Usher Raymond. You're right. Okay. I forgot about that. Anyway, this guy his name is Jesse T. Usher. I don't know.
Well, why don't you know?
Sorry. It flew out of my head for a second that was the deal. Anyway, he plays the son of Will Smith, who died between movies for reasons never quite explained. And he's now, like, a hotshot fighter pilot, and he's got a big rivalry with Liam Hemsworth, proving again that he is the least of all Hemsworths. And Hemsworth is in love with not Mae Whitman, and blah, 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 blah. And then Area 51, and then apparently there's a gay couple that I completely missed, because it's handled so, like, as somebody put it, haze code-ishly.
Right.
So unless you're really paying attention, you're not even going to notice that they're there. Vivica Fox has magically become...
Roland Emmerich is so proud of having put that gay couple in the movie.
Oh, yeah, I know. Thanks for the
progress.
Like,
he mentions it.
Oh,
he,
I know.
In interviews, he's like, yes, we've made strides.
Yeah. not so much. Vivica Fox...
He is such a weirdo.
Yeah.
What is his deal?
He is another generation. Bless his heart. Vivica Fox, I guess, because, you know, Will Smith saved the world in the first one, she got to leave stripping and get a medical scholarship because now she's a doctor.
Well, she made enough money from stripping to go to medical
school. No. I think she probably got some government grants, probably, with, you know, what with the husband, you know, saving the earth. That's got to count for something.
Maybe they did send her to free college.
A lot has changed in 20 years for Vivica
Fox. Why isn't that story in the movie?
Well, she's barely in it as well. I mean, there's like, she's got about...
Why can't she be piloting a ship?
If only. No, her son gets to, but not her.
Why not Vivica Fox?
Well, Cela Ward gets to be president now. That's kind of cool.
Why not Vivica Fox being president and piloting a ship?
That would be great.
Bill Pullman got to do that.
And the other cool thing is that there is actually sort of global peace because, as Watchmen suggests, if the Earth has to band together for, you know, to fight an enemy from without, that's actually a way to sort of, you know, bring us together as a human race.
I don't care about this anymore.
Anyway,
I'm going to go, but I don't care about listening to this anymore.
I'm sorry I'm boring you.
No, it's not you. It's not you, it's the film.
I have read some very vitriolic reviews of this movie, and I've seen worse this year.
Well, yeah. Listen, those vitriolic reviews for a big, big, high-profile film, you know what that's about.
Well, I don't know.
But
here's the thing. I wrote a vitriolic review for Warcraft, and people accuse me of what you're implying about reviews of this one. I genuinely was in agony for that entire film.
Okay, but here's the thing. You know what kind of reviews I'm talking about.
Yeah, I suppose so.
They're on, like, sites that aren't, you know, the rap.
Mm-hmm.
And they're often quite funny because of their fury.
Right.
And they're meant to make a name for the person who wrote it.
Maybe. I think some of the people who are writing vitriolic reviews already have a name, but whatever.
Who with a name was writing a vitriolic review?
I'm not
going to
say.
Because I do want to watch. I do want to go read that. Because that'll probably be someone I know and like.
I'm not positive. I've been sort of gleaning this from Twitter. I haven't really dug through to read them all. But it's, you know, it is whatever. You know, if you're there for the air conditioning, and you cannot think about this movie for a second. You cannot think about why is the guy who is auditing Jeff Goldblum following him to Africa and then the moon. You know, why is the African warlord going to the moon? I'm it's bananas.
Put Vivica Fox and Charlotte Gainsbourg in the spaceship killing machine. Let them pilot it and kill the spaceship. Let them be the people who save the world again. Do it. That's my Independence Day. The one that I'm going to make
in your mind.
In my mind.
Well, yeah, you're not getting that one. So yeah, so
nobody ever has ideas that are as good as mine.
No.
Why not?
Because Roland Emmerich, who you were telling me he's like standing his ground on Stonewall.
Oh yeah, yeah. He actually says in an interview this week, "Oh, that was a white event." I'm like, oh, yeah? Are you sure about that?
Honey, no.
Accounts do differ and all, but not that much.
Here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Even if he's right, that movie is still...
Sucks.
...a heaping pile of garbage.
And that's why we didn't get to see this one.
Oh, interesting.
Here's my theory.
That he's still mad about the Stonewall reviews?
I have no proof. I'm speculating entirely, and I do not know if what I'm about to say is right or wrong. But in my mind, the same mind that knows that this film would have been better if Vivica Fox and Charlotte Gainsbourg could save the world.
That mind, yes.
Somebody's widow feelings were hurt by those Stonewall reviews. And if Tyler Perry's got the juice not to show his films to critics...
Oh, true.
...then you know Roland Emmerich does.
Yeah.
And I'm going to guess that Mr. Emmerich said... Oh, yeah? Well, no.
Nine!
Yeah. They didn't like my last film, which was From the Heart.
My important movie about history.
Right. That's what I'm thinking.
I like that theory.
Roland Emmerich, are you listening to our podcast?
Of course he is.
Why don't you come on and tell us otherwise? If I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. Come on the show, tell me I'm wrong. Also tell us about what really happened at Stonewall. And why did you make such a crappy Godzilla movie?
Ugh. So many questions for Mr. Emmerich.
Come on to the show. We're going to take you to task, mister.
But we'll also tell you how great White House Down was.
Yes.
Because it was.
Praise where it is due.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so speaking of movies that are dumb that are great, we saw The Shallows.
Yes. You know, I think it was John Waters who made the joke about how there aren't B-movies anymore because they now all cost at least $100 million and they're A-movies.
Yes.
But that basically what used to sort of be the bastard genres of the cinema are now the summer tent poles.
Yes.
So there's something to be said for somebody who just wants to make a sort of lean and mean, unapologetic genre movie. And I am a big fan of director Jomolekole Sarah.
Me too.
For making exactly that kind of movie.
Oh, yeah.
I was sort of on his House of Wax remake, but it had some moments. That guy got his Achilles tendon cut. That was that was unforgettable.
That was good.
Paris Hilton got melted.
That was good.
But, you know, he made the fun Liam Neeson post-Taken movies.
That's true.
Unknown, Nonstop, and Run All Night.
And
Orphan. And now he gives us The Shallows. And it's like,
please watch Orphan. Everybody listening, everyone within the sound
if you can
of
hear my
ears,
voice.
If you can hear my voice, please watch Orphan. It is the greatest film of all time. And I don't lie to you about things that are the greatest film of all time. When I tell you that Orphan is the greatest film of all time, I mean it.
This is an episode where I'm going to be talking about O Hazard Balthazar later, and you're still going to tell me that Orphan is the greatest film of all time.
Yes.
Okay.
It is tied with O Hazard Balthazar.
Just so we're clear. So yeah, so The Shallows is... Well, hey, I talked about the last one you do.
Okay, so Blake Lively is in Mexico. She's at a beach. No one will tell her the name of the beach. She keeps asking people. They're like... we're not going to tell you. You know why? It's called Shark Beach.
I think if the locals knew that, they wouldn't surf there either, but they do.
And so she goes there to surf. And she's a medical school dropout.
Right. Because her mom died.
Because her mom died, and she's grieving, and she dropped out of medical school.
And this is a beach that her mother went to...
When she was pregnant
with Blake Lively.
And then she gets on the surfboard and surfs. They have not super improved on the face switching technology.
Oh, it didn't stand out to me as bad.
It was there. You could see it.
Okay.
You were looking at her face during the surfing places.
Somebody I know.
You could tell that it wasn't Blake Lively.
Somebody I know on Facebook referred to this movie as Blue Crush White Death.
They put Blake Lively's face on the person.
Okay. I didn't notice so much.
Not perfectly, not seamlessly.
Gotcha.
And that's the first thing that makes this movie not perfect, but pretty great. So then comes the shark, and the shark is eating people, and then there's an injured seagull.
Yes.
That gets trapped with Blake Lively on a rock. The seagull has a broken wing. And Blake Lively has a big gash in her leg from swimming away very quickly from the shark and scratching it deeply on some nasty coral.
Yes, like the kind that burns like a jellyfish
stone. Yeah. Now, this rock is not that far from the shore. She can see the shore. She can wave to people on the shore. She can yell and scream at people on the shore.
She speaks very little Spanish, however.
Yeah.
One of the words that she does not know is tiburón.
Um, So she can't go anywhere because the between the shore and the rock is the shark. She's stuck. But then she MacGruber's her way out of everything.
Totally.
And that's exciting.
Yes.
Because it all makes logical sense. The stuff that she can do based on her medical school skills.
Right.
And the stuff that can happen. The only thing that can't quite... Well, I won't say that it can't happen.
Well, and also we should point out, the reason that the shark is showed is in the shallows in the first place is because there's a big whale carcass floating around nearby.
Yeah.
So she is basically the orange slice next to the steak.
Yeah.
Because really, how much nutrition can you get out of one Blake Lively?
Furthermore, sharks don't like the way people taste.
Is that true?
They spit you right back out. I mean, they might eat you. But they'll be like, that wasn't very good. I'm never coming to this Wendy's again.
Even like you and me, we have like kind of a marbling happening.
I think I'd be pretty delicious.
Yeah. We're kind of like...
You know, when you go to get the carnitas at Los Tacos next to the laundromat, or rather, when I say you, I mean me.
You, yes.
Like I did this morning, actually, for breakfast.
I feel like my liver is not unlike the geese that live on the pate farm.
What's great about those carnitas at Los Tacos next to the laundromat that I went to at 7 a.m. this morning for tacos.
Whoa.
That's a good breakfast. Carnitas tacos.
Do they do a breakfast taco there or no?
Yeah, it's called a taco.
You know what I mean.
They are open 24 hours a day.
Yes, but some places have specific like eggy breakfast.
Oh, they do have a breakfast menu.
Yeah.
But I don't need that.
You just want the carnitas.
I need that taco.
Okay.
It's got the carnitas and cilantro.
No.
Salsa. And it's hot sauce, really.
I'm not a fan of that place in general, but I agree with you. Those carnitas tacos are real good.
Onions. And that's a delightful breakfast.
Onion power.
Correct. So, it's everything that you would put into an omelet, so who cares?
Yeah.
Their carnitas, the reason their carnitas are so good is because they do not really trim the fat off that stuff very much.
Mm.
So you'll bite into that carnitas taco. Just get a big old mouthful of like fatty pork. Therefore, I'm thinking I'd be fairly tasty to a shark. Because I got a lot of fatty portions on me. I'm delicious.
Human belly.
Yeah. This belly just isn't to sexually allure the planet. That's its primary job.
It is to tantalize sharks.
It is also to tantalize a shark. If I ever went into the ocean, and I don't. Okay, so then she fights the shark. It's really great. Obviously, you know, if I tell you what happens at the end, is that a spoiler? It's not really a spoiler.
Let's not get too...
Do you actually... Okay, the thing that happens at the end is really stupid.
But great.
But great. So, don't go into this movie saying, this better all be, you know, sense-making.
Yeah, I want logic here. No, I'm not going
to
get it.
Up to the end, it's logical, and then at the end, it goes haywire. And, and by that point, you're just so happy to be watching the film.
I was going to say, even though it goes completely off the rails, you're still like, woo, you know.
And I am pro Blake Lively.
I got nothing against her.
Yeah.
I'm not like, I didn't see Age of Adeline, and
Age of Adeline is not a good movie, but let me tell you, anybody who hasn't seen Age of Adeline, do you like to watch Blake Lively wear outfits? Yes, you do.
I say, it is her clothes horse
it's
Kentucky Derby, right?
It's the outfitness movie. Not since Audrey Hepburn have we been treated to this level of outfit.
Wow.
Yeah.
More so than Anne Hathaway in Devil Wears Prada?
Oh, for miles ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Anne Hathaway spends half of Devil Wears Prada
looking
frumpy and feeling self-satisfied about it.
Mm-hmm.
Blake Lively, from start to finish of Age of Adeline, she
turns
it out. She is on fire with the outfits.
Right, but if, if you don't start frumpy,
and then it changes like every 3 minutes.
You don't get the Katie Tunstall like montage.
I don't care. Katie Tunstall. But I know that person's name is your fault.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm serious.
It's not like I own anything she's ever done.
You taught me her name.
Well, sorry.
Thank you for being sorry about that.
How much dumb music have you inflicted upon
me?
I've
never inflicted any dumb music on you. No. I've only given you impeccably choiced musics.
Look, suddenly I see is a nice little pop confection. I'm never going to buy it. I don't need to because it just pops up in my life periodically.
Yeah.
But it is a perfectly fine little summer jam bauble.
Pilar sitting on the sofa over there. Have you ever seen Age of Adeline? You need to watch that movie.
I like clothes.
It's not good, but boy, the clothes. Yeah. You're a lady. You like clothes. You're wearing clothes right now.
I am, yeah. And I love it.
Incidentally, Micah Monroe in Independence Day Resurgence is less convincing as a fighter pilot than Blake Lively in Green Lantern.
I believe her as a fighter pilot in Green Lantern.
Well, she wasn't just a fighter. She wasn't just a fighter pilot. She was the president
Denise Richards
of an aeronautics
and scientist
company.
Christmas Jones. In that Bond movie, too.
Very well, then.
Yeah. I was like, if that's The Shallows, it's great.
It's fun.
Yeah.
I had a blast.
The Neon Demon.
Oi!
He has good clothes.
Oh! Also has good clothes.
Yes. Yes. Definitely.
Why don't you tell people what happens in The Neon Demon?
Brother. So... Orphaned Elle Fanning,
yes.
Age 16, right. Comes to Los Angeles, does a sort of bloody couture photo layout shot by the dude from Gaspar Noé's Love.
Yes.
Immediately becomes the toast of the town. Joan from Mad Men becomes her agent. Jenna Malone is like a makeup artist. And Bella Heathcote and Abby Lane?
Abby Lee, who's actually a model.
Abby Normal are both immediately like threatened by her because she becomes the new It Girl, and designers like Alessandro Nivola want to work with her. And she lives in a skeezy motel in Pasadena, managed by an unhinged Keanu Reeves. And when she walks,
he's gross. I liked him.
He was great. Yeah. She walks a big runway show, and there's this. Pink neon pyramid made up of triangles that sort of looks like it could be a demon, and suddenly her hair gets straightened and she becomes a lot more vampy, and then terrible things happen, and then what the hell, Nicholas Winding Refn?
Is that, have we not yet learned how to pronounce his name?
That's how you say it, I believe.
No, it's not.
Seriously, yes.
No.
What do you think, it's Vinding?
It's probably like Vinding Rain or something like that.
I've heard Winding Refn. And I'm sticking.
I mean, I've always hoped that's how it was.
I'm sticking to that until I hear a definitive proof otherwise. Oh my God, this guy! Not only does he make these ridiculous movies that are all style and like negative substance, he feels the need to put his monogram on the opening and closing credits just in case we weren't noticing who's auteuring the hell out of this thing. During this movie, I was thinking, you know, it really is a big gap in my cinematic education that I have not seen Looker or Eyes of Laura Mars, because all I could think of is like, this is a movie that is going to be mentioned in the same breath with them and Mahogany, because it's about the treacherous high glam world of couture fashion, and it's stone cold stupid, this movie. And it would, if it were any less stupid, it would be genuinely offensive. Like, if it were a real movie, lesbians should burn down every theater that's showing it. As it is, it's so redonk that you can't even be upset about it because it's just inane. However, I'm glad I saw it because it is art directed to a shine, and you know, the whoever supplies Mr. Winding Refn with his like purple and green, you know, gels is still very much employed. But oh brother, as I said today when the movie was over, this is like Mulholland Drive if Mulholland Drive hadn't been about anything
and had been made by like the horniest dude in the world.
Yeah. who hates women.
This was very, this is a very bad movie. With, thematically, it is so trite.
Mm-hmm.
And unsurprising.
Yeah. Like, I was promised Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. That's what Christy Lemire compared it to.
The only thing I heard about it going in was someone said, if you like Showgirls.
Mm.
But this is the problem, see?
Showgirls knows what it's doing.
Showgirls is a masterpiece. I will say it until the day I die.
Yes.
Showgirls is a deranged art film that is doing everything it's doing very specifically for a reason.
And Showgirls is made by people who know what they're saying and are saying it.
But more importantly to me, Showgirls understands how tacky the world is.
Yeah. Or America, anyway.
And this version of that story where everyone is horrible and doing horrible things to one another, there's nothing tacky about it. It's gorgeous. And people are not given to stupid, frivolous speech. They barely speak at all.
Yeah.
They compose their sentences carefully. They deliver them somberly.
Mm-hmm. Scandinavianly, one writes.
They walk away in an amazing outfit. Unless they are Keanu Reeves, and he's disgusting. Now,
but is that even? I mean, he's vocally disgusting. He is visually, yeah, Keanu Reeves.
Visually,
with a beard.
He still looks like Keanu Reeves. Yeah. So yeah, I just wanted to be established that this is a bad film, and I kind of almost liked ish. Yes, I did. Only God forgives.
Ugh,
that everyone else hated.
Hated it.
The
look, I haven't seen all of his movies, but the only...
I've seen most of them.
The only one that I will go to bat for is Bronson. Like, that movie is super stylish, but it's using its style to say something and to comment upon something. Drive, I thought, was, you know, stylish and had its moments, but I ultimately didn't super get invested in the characters. And then, you know, I don't despise Neon Demon as much as I just flat out hated Only God Forgives. But both of these movies feel like someone who's trying to be David Lynch desperately, but has no, there's no there. There's nothing backing up this phantasmagoria of, you know, gore and hyper stylized imagery.
There's joy with David Lynch.
Mm.
There's pleasure.
There's a soul.
There's a goofy dude,
yeah,
at the core of a David Lynch movie.
Isn't this great?
There's a very male director at the core of Nicholas W.F.'s
W.R.'s.
W.R., sorry. I think he does not understand how to write female characters.
That's fair.
I think he's best when he is working with dudes fighting dudes. Valhalla Rising.
I was going to say, that
boy howdy.
That Viking movie.
Right? I like that one. It's a bunch.
Did you see the Pusher movies?
I saw one of the Pusher movies. Mm-hmm. Also.
Dudes fighting
very
dudes.
Very cool.
And Bronson, dudes fighting dudes.
Dudes. Dudes, 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 dudes. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I don't want to be sitting around as, you know, witnessing you do your homework. Go do your homework somewhere else.
Yeah.
Then come back.
Show me what you've learned.
Show me what you've learned. Yeah. Having said that, I am with you in that I am really glad that I saw this movie today. Partly for reasons that are exterior to the film.
Mm-hmm.
I love going to the movies with you.
Thank you.
My number one choice is going alone.
Uh-huh.
My number two choice is going with you.
Okay. Especially when we're in a practically empty theater.
Especially like when we're in a practically empty theater like we were this morning. There were three other people in the theater with us, and one of them left midway through the movie.
Everybody I know who has been posting pictures of themselves at this movie has been like, here I am in an empty theater watching The Neon Demon. It's apparently tanking.
The air conditioning was Artists Plaza 8 level cold.
I was cold.
So I was in fat man heaven.
I was thinking I should have brought a light wrap.
A light wrap.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the thing you do when you choose a person to spend your life with is the things you do together that give you pleasure.
Mm.
And one of the things that you and I do is go to the movies. This is our job, but it's also our fun.
Right.
And so I just like being there with you seeing a movie. It makes me happy. Even if we're seeing this movie.
Maybe especially when we're seeing this movie.
Kind of, because by about midway through, we started whispering goofy stuff to each other.
I was reminded of like seeing Crash with you at times.
The racism
one. Yes, the dumb Crash, not the good Crash.
Not the good Crash by David Cronenberg.
This movie wishes it was the good Crash.
I think that's a really good point. I feel like we get confused sometimes when we are making a film that is chilly.
Mm.
And you're going for Cronenberg.
Yeah.
In Crash. And maybe you're getting there and maybe you're not. This one did not. I think
chilly works when there's an understanding that there's layers to these characters that they're making it a point not to reveal to each other,
right,
but that we're able to glean through other things.
Yeah.
And then there's just nothing else going on behind the window. Right. You know.
Lesbians, you gotta go see this. Cause this is future lesbian camp.
I think so.
And people who like gross, gory, nasty, gory stuff, you got to go see this, because there's at least two or three really gnarly things that go down in this movie, and they're hilarious, and they're nasty. And so this movie's bad and fun and gross and stupid and stylish and beautiful and not what I think he wanted to make. I completely recommend that you go see this film.
I think that this is a legitimate camp movie because I don't think the director understands what he's made. I think he has accidentally stumbled upon something that certain audiences are going to find hilarious in that black swan kind of way. Okay. And he thinks he's doing something super serioso about like the industry or
failed art.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the definition of camp.
Yeah.
Failed art. And
may I present The Neon Demon?
Neither I nor you saw Free State of Jones.
Correct. And with any luck, we never will.
I almost went to the press screening Wednesday night. Mm-hmm. You could not for some reason.
I had an Outfest thing.
But you weren't going to, you didn't need to see it to review it for the wrap. You
had already sent somebody.
Somebody else went to see it. And I wasn't reviewing it in writing this week. And I thought, when I woke up Wednesday morning, the very first thought in my head when I woke up Wednesday morning was, but I don't want to see Free State of Jones. Part of me thinks I should. Because I want an example of the kind of slavery movie that you shouldn't make.
Right.
Even if it was based on a true story. And this apparently is based on a true story.
To the point where there are apparently on-screen footnotes.
Okay.
Like, they are, like, true-storing the heck out of you on this one, apparently, from what I hear.
All right.
Not that that makes it any more interesting, from what I hear.
It's not about whether it's interesting or not. I feel like the idea of a slavery movie where a white guy fixes everything is kind of gross.
Yeah. I bet you
Abraham Lincoln was a white guy who helped fix slavery.
But we already had that movie.
Right. It's funny, you were saying, why did they release it in the summer when it's such so clearly kind of an awards baity kind of movie?
It's meant to be an awardsy movie.
I think I know exactly why.
Tell me.
They are getting the hell out of the way of Birth of a Nation.
The Birth of a Nation. Yeah. And they probably should.
Yeah, because I think that movie, Amanda, which I didn't see at Sundance, unfortunately, it showed after I left, that's going to be the slave revolt movie with black heroes made by a black director. And so this movie from a white director. About a white guy. They did not want to be in the same time.
They wanted it to slink away quietly.
Yeah.
Rather than be the subject of.
They didn't want to come out, be compared to it during, and they certainly didn't want to come out after. So it's like, all right, let's do it now.
It's getting terrible reviews.
Oh, awful
reviews. So I'm sort of fascinated, on that level.
But I mean, but not even awful reviews like that it's merely a white savior movie. And some people say it is ish, but not entirely.
Okay.
But what they say is that it's super dry and academic and uninvolving and overloaded with stuff. Like there's these flash forwards to the 1930s.
Okay.
It's just everything I've read about it. I just thought,
Let me tell you about the Free State of Jones.
I don't know. Well, no, it's something. It's different than that. But it's a sort of correlative thing. But everything I've read about, it's like, I don't want to see that. No, thank you.
Okay, so no Free State of Jones.
You saw Swiss Army Man, which I did not.
I wrote a review of Swiss Army Man for the Wrap.
Yes, you did.
You should go read it.
It's
linked on my Facebook wall, D. Leland Dwight.
It's on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's on Rotten Tomatoes. You can find it.
Or just go to therap.com.
Even if you don't want to read the review because you're going to go see the movie and you don't like to read reviews until after, give me that click. Paul Dano is apparently shipwrecked somewhere, alone, sending help me messages off in little... cute little boats and bottles and things that he makes. But he's all alone. Doesn't feel like he has any hope of being rescued. So he tries to kill himself. That's the opening scene of the movie. We meet him mid trying to hang himself. He's not very good at trying to hang himself. He's not very good at life, you'll find out during the rest of the film. But he's not very good at trying to hang himself. So as he's trying to hang himself, he's flailing around, and he sees a body washed up on shore. That body is the corpse of Daniel Radcliffe. And it is farting. It is farting atomic farts. Nuclear mega farts. The kind that allow Paul Dano to take him and immediately use him as a jet ski to propel himself to another land. That's the beginning of the movie.
Okay.
All right.
So they go to a better island?
It's unclear where they go to.
Okay.
Because logistics are not what this film
paramount
cares,
in the,
cares about.
Yeah.
And as you get to know them, these two new pals, Paul Dano is using Daniel Radcliffe's body to do a variety of chores, hence the title of the film. He's a weapon. He's a water fountain. What else is he using for? The things. And then the corpse begins to speak. And he says his name is Manny. And he's pretty much E.T. He's asking all these questions. What's this for? What's that? And Paul Dano's job is teaching Manny about how human beings are. And what they do and what they need and how they live and all that stuff.
Did Manny have a life before becoming a corpse?
We don't know.
I see. Okay.
We are never told.
Gotcha.
To help him explain things, he builds a world. He builds a movie theater. He builds the interior of a bus. And as I said in the review, it is Michel Gondry's Gilligan's Island. He even dresses himself up in drag out of, coconuts and things, you know what I mean? To impersonate the woman that is on his screensaver on his phone, and that is Mary Elizabeth Winstead, a woman he has been pining after for years on the bus as he rides
in his daily commute, oh so lonely, on the bus. And that's when that's when it gets all goopy. Because Daniel Radcliffe is...
What is it to be a human?
Yeah, yeah. It says things like, no one should have to ride the bus alone.
No.
Yeah. And this is when the indie, you know, folk score kicks in.
Of course.
Whoa, whoa, you know. And...
So this is this year's Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. A deep movie for 14-year-olds
yes
of all ages.
Yes and no, it's better than that.
Okay.
It is almost successful. The things that sink it are some choices that I wish the filmmakers had not made. Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
Daniels is Daniel Kwan and Daniel Skynyrt? I don't know how you say his last name. They directed Lil Jon's Turn Down for What video, which has 500 million hits on YouTube. And that's not a number I made up. It has over 500 million hits on YouTube. For a reason. It's perfect. It is absurd body comedy where people's breasts and butts and penises spin them out of control. And they all have to party because their breasts and their butts and their boners cannot stop wiggling and vibrating and moving and jumping up and down and hurling them through walls. And it's delightful. That same visual invention is what you see in a lot of their music videos. They have a website where you can look at all their stuff. And that visual invention is the best part of this film. The goofy, weird special effects stuff that happens in this movie makes it really watchable. And I would recommend it for that alone. But the insights of this script about human contact and human connection and loneliness and what happens to adults as they navigate the world like a well-mannered person. It's everything from Catcher in the Rye to Rebel Without a Cause to The Breakfast Club to The Fault in Our Stars. If everybody would just keep it real, man. Because you know what happens when you grow up? Your heart dies.
So don't be a phony.
Guess what? I know this already. I'm a grown-ass man, and I know these things. Maybe if you're 18 and you haven't had... you know, the world crush you enough yet.
Right.
You haven't quite learned these things yet. And this film will seem fairly profound.
Full of heavy insights.
Heavy insights. But it's not. These insights are not heavy. They're what everyone already knows. I will say one more thing about what I like. The ending gives up a lot of ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that. I appreciated their commitment to not fully explaining what's really going on versus what might really be going on. My takeaway is that this is a man with mental health issues who stumbles across a corpse and transfers his pain to it.
Hmm.
I don't even believe that he is genuinely shipwrecked at the beginning of the movie.
Hmm. He's metaphorically shipwrecked?
Yeah. And so... even though the movie plays back and forth, plays it
sure,
very fast and loose way, with, yeah. It could be either way, yeah. It's almost good.
Hmm.
And worth looking at because of what I believe is the beginning of something possibly very cool with these two filmmakers. I want them to move away from, you know, special feelings. And telling me stuff I already know.
Mm.
And there's even a shout out to the Turn Down for What video in this film. Mm. You still haven't seen that video.
I have not.
You really need to go watch.
Okay.
It's so much fun.
I'm reminded. Remember that somebody online did the joke MTV Cribs for Michelle Gondry?
Yes.
And at one point, he was like, he has a refrigerator that's a cardboard box. He says, I built this when a woman broke my heart. It is still cold inside.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. Wiener dog.
Wiener dog.
Do we make me first and then wiener dog?
Yeah, okay. We can do that. That's a good segue.
Now we begin. Wait a second.
What?
Hang on. Hold up.
All right. I'm just sitting here.
Do you subscribe to us yet? I'm going to do a little commercial.
Okay.
No, you say? I haven't had time to go to the Patreon page and look at it. What is that Patreon page URL?
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. One word.
P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Patreon. Do you subscribe to us? You should. You get lots of things. Not only do you get t-shirts and mugs and tote bags and other items that you will like, but some zines, and you get club meetings where we all watch a movie together, and you get a curated object. I know I just said the word curated and I should be murdered for that, but I'm sorry. You get a selected object by us 4 times a year, depending on the level that you subscribe at. But at the base level, $4 a month, you get LKTV, which is vital to you and how you are watching the television.
It is a podcast of the television.
That's right. That's all I'm going to say. This is a short and sweet commercial by us, for us, to you, with love.
We had a great club meeting last night where we all watched Millennium Actress on YouTube.
Right.
And, you're missing out.
You are.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife.
$4 a month. That is a stone cheap amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, okay, so we are beginning a segment.
On this show
that we call Make Me.
Yes.
The premise here is that I have known you for over 21 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have almost been a love couple with you for almost 21.
Yep. More than 20.
I've known you longer than 21, and I've almost been your special
man. We've been a couple for more than 20.
For almost 21.
Yes.
In October.
Yes.
21 years.
Yes.
So.
And yet, in all that time.
Because we are both film critics.
There are still.
We've spent 21 years going to the movies and talking about movies.
Mm-hmm.
Only 5 of them on this podcast. So many conversations that you guys missed before we started this podcast. And we continuously
have the what? You haven't seen that?
How come I haven't made you sit down and watch this yet? So now we're doing it.
Yes.
We're making each other sit down and watch things. And I picked the first one.
Correct.
Because it connects to a new film that's released this week that we are reviewing.
Right.
We are reviewing Wiener Dog, the new film from Todd Solondz.
But for the first Make Me, I watched Robert Bresson's Au Hasard Balthazar.
Yes.
It was my first Bresson movie.
Yes.
Why don't you tell
people,
okay,
what it's about and what you think. Because I have spent 5 years,
yes,
turning Robert Bresson into a drinking game, apparently.
Yes.
He's my favorite filmmaker. He's made my favorite films. Au Hasard Balthazar is my all-time favorite movie.
And Orphan.
Also Orphan.
Okay, so Au Hasard Balthazar is set in the French countryside.
1966.
Yes, and it opens with a young donkey nursing at his mother's teat. And he is pulled away by a family. The children baptize him, and name him Balthazar.
Yeah.
And he lives with them. There is one child who is sick. There is it's two families, and the son of one pledges his undying love to the daughter from another, and they're both 8 or 9 years old. Time passes. Balthazar changes hands and is put to work and works and works and works. There is dissension among the families. One of them has been managing the lands of the other one, and even though the father has been doing everything on the up and up, there are rumors that he is mishandling the land or the accounts, but he refuses to prove otherwise. The young girl grows up, and even though the boy continues to be in love with her, she is in turn besotted with this...
A bad boy.
Bad guy.
Yeah.
And Balthazar endures and suffers and dies. The end. What else is there to say? So Bresson is about as fat-free a filmmaker as I've ever seen.
That's right.
It's very... if you've ever seen an Ozu movie, like Tokyo Story,
yes,
he is just cleaves to the bone. Like, there is no excess emotion. There is no excess plot or characterization or characters.
Let's be more specific. There is no emotion.
There is no emotion at all. It is very, very spare and sere, S-E-R-E, this movie.
You got feelings? GTFO.
Yeah.
There's a lot of religious metaphor here of Balthazar's suffering. He could be read as Jesus or Job, I suppose, in various ways. But I think, you know, you talk a lot about sort of the conflict of Bresson's spirituality, because I think there's an inherent thing here of like, yes, Balthazar suffers, we all suffer, that's just the way the world is, tough. You know, there's no respite, and there is no glory, and there is no redemption. There is only suffering and death. And so I can see why you are a fan of this. But it's beautiful and it's powerful, and that donkey is a star. You know, our friend Kyle Buchanan at Vulture wrote a whole piece about how the seagull in The Shallows is like the breakout actor of the summer.
That seagull is great. That seagull is no Black Phillip.
True, yeah.
Yeah.
But Black Phillip is no Balthazar. Balthazar is the Brando of asses. it is great. It is a great movie, I grant you. And I'm glad I saw it. And yeah, I'm certainly glad I saw it now that we are discussing Wiener Dog, because Todd Solondz's film about an animal who is passed around from owner to owner and who suffers silently and absorbs the sins of others, certainly owes a debt to Balthazar. And Solondz has said that he was influenced by both O Hazard Balthazar and Benji.
Yes. So
I would argue The Giving Tree probably also.
Before we start talking about Wiener Dog, I want to talk about Balthazar more.
Oh, sure. Okay.
One of the things I really love about it is it's at the beginning of that next phase of Bresson's career. His earlier films, they move toward the direction that he wound up in.
Films like
A Man Escaped, Pickpocket.
Diary of a Country Priest?
Yeah, Diary of a Country Priest. And Diary of a Country Priest is a sort of a different style. There's certainly a line that you're watching being drawn. But he returns to the well of Christianity again and again. And it's difficult to pin him down. And that's one reason I love him. Because he's making films about religious subjects and never ever fully tipping his hand to you about what he believes. The level of ambiguity
and austerity in his filmmaking can be is it is such that you can walk out of O Hasard Baltasar and think of it as a fairly atheistic film.
Sure, yeah.
Or you can walk out of it thinking that it's kind of a, you know,
spiritual
film. A declaration of faith almost.
Right.
In that he is intentionally, well, let me back up a little bit. His style involves an essay I recently read by a film writer, French critic, René Prédal, in this huge, thick, 600-page book called Robert Bresson Revised, edited by James Quant.
That I gave you for Christmas.
That you gave me for Christmas. Maybe the best Christmas gift I've ever been given. He talks about Bresson's films as, and this is a quote, a representative system of objects and sounds. And that is a pretty perfect description of what he's doing. So much representative and repetitive things, materials of his films, they are the subject. And so much incredible sound design that is used thematically.
Mm.
You know, Baltasar is one of the names of the three wise men.
Oh, right, yeah.
Saint Baltasar.
Baltasar, Melchior, and yeah. Somebody else.
Christ rode into Jerusalem on a donkey.
Right.
Why? Because the donkey is nothing.
Humble.
The donkey is not a glorious horse.
No.
The victorious armies ride the horses.
Right.
The peasants, the poor people who are nothing, they have the donkeys. The donkeys are the work beasts.
Right. The beasts of burden.
And so the symbolism of Christ riding into Jerusalem on a donkey is he made himself nothing.
Right.
And
he is at the level of humanity.
Yeah. So repeatedly throughout this film, you hear people refer to Baltasar as a saint,
mm-hmm.
as intellect itself at one point. He is mocked for being a dumb donkey, mm-hmm. by the bad kids on their mopeds who talk about how sleek and modern he is.
Right.
But they're making fun of him. Right. And they're making fun of the farmer who uses him instead of
a tractor,
instead of more modern farming methods. Yeah.
They are mocking peasantry itself.
Yes. Finally, as Baltasar suffers, is abused, set on fire by one of the bad boys.
Yeah.
Is constantly mute, and they talk about him, as sort of imparting grace,
mm-hmm.
on the people around him. To me, therefore, he is a Christ figure. And his death in a field of sheep.
He lays down with the lambs.
Yeah. And ignored by those
sheep. Or lies down.
Yeah. Ignored by those sheep.
Yeah.
The end. I think of this as the story, a tale of the Christ. I mean, that's, for me, that's what this is.
Yeah.
But it's got so much reluctance to give in to any kind of warmth or the kind of coddling that a religious audience would want from a religious film.
No, I agree.
They would walk out and say, I don't know what this is about.
You could totally have a justifiable atheist read on this film.
Right.
That basically man suffers in a void and dies.
Yeah.
The end.
So I think Wiener Dog is the atheist Baltasar.
Hmm.
That is, I said that in my review on the wrap this week. I reviewed two movies for the wrap this week.
Yes, Swiss Army Man and Wiener Dog.
I think of Wiener Dog as the atheist Baltasar.
Okay.
Because Wiener Dog
can't help anyone.
Can't help anyone, and is completely ineffectual as the kind of transubstantiation machine that people use Balthazar for.
As a sin eater.
Yeah. Everyone just suffers in Wiener Dog. She goes from a family of uptight rich jerks with a little boy who is a cancer survivor.
Right.
And the parents are so unhappy having a dog that the father trains it in a horribly, you know, unpleasant way.
Tracy Letts. The father brings the dog home in the first place.
Yes.
Over the wife's objections.
And then...
Julie Delpy.
And then doesn't even want to be bothered with training it and is angry at the dog all the time. Then the mom... When the kid feeds the poor dog... I can't remember now what...
Granola bars.
Yeah.
With chocolate chips, incidentally. Yeah.
The greatest shot in the movie.
God.
Ed Lockman can make anything beautiful. This astounding cinematographer.
This tracking shot.
A tracking shot, this long dolly of just an endless pool of dog diarrhea.
This stream that goes on, like, next to a curb.
And then the dog hemorrhages. They take her to the vet to have her put down.
Yeah.
And she's rescued there by grown-up Dawn Wiener.
Now played by Greta Gerwig.
Who then takes...
who renames her...
Duty.
Duty.
She has no name at first. She's just called, I think,
Wiener Dog. Yeah. Is the kid keeps calling her, yeah.
And she runs into... Dawn Wiener runs into grown-up Brandon, her tormentor from Welcome to the Dollhouse, now played by Kieran Culkin, in a convenience store. They hit the road. They don't care where they're going or why.
He's going somewhere.
He wants to go visit his brother.
Yeah, and she's happy to tag along.
But they're fairly aimless about it. They eventually wind up at the brother's house.
Yeah, there's some other thing happening that we're not clear about. It seems like it might be some sort of shady drug business or something.
Yes, because he's a drug addict.
Yeah.
They wind up at the brother's house. The brother and his wife, they both have Down syndrome. Right. They love Duty.
Mm-hmm.
And she's left there with them.
Yeah. Dawn thinks they would be better parents.
Yeah. The film then goes into a sort of intermission where there's a song about Wiener Dog.
The Ballad of the Wiener Dog, written by Mark Shaman.
And then we are shown that she has somehow been transferred to the ownership of Danny DeVito, who is a...
Film professor.
A film professor.
Screenwriting professor.
A film professor and a has-been screenwriter.
Has-been slash would-be screenwriter.
He's had a film.
He's had one film produced, and he spends a lot of the time on the phone with various agents.
Who don't care about him.
Yeah.
Then... But he is so resentful and so depressed, and his students hate him.
Yeah.
And they've got new ideas about making films, more modern ideas about making films. And his old-fashioned idea is a constant refrain.
What if, then what? But mind you, Salon lets you know what side he's on when they're interviewing a prospective student. And the student's talking about how much he loves films and wants to make films. Like, well, what films really changed your life? Oh, gosh, there's just so many. And they're like, well, in the last 6 months, what films have you seen? Oh, God, just, you know, I can't do that. Name a film. And he can't even
and
do that.
And the kid says, I know this is a trick question. And but later you see other film students who kind of have a point about Danny DeVito's.
Sure, yes.
Like, stuck in his mud ways.
Right. But the thing is, yes, that does happen. But a lot of the times when the films, the people that are talking to DeVito, they come in wanting to make a movie about an idea or about an end point, but they have no story to tell.
Right.
And he very rightly points that fact out.
Right.
And this has been a recurring thing in...
Yes.
Salon's movies.
Yes.
Film professors and film students.
Yes. Well, he is a film professor.
Salons is?
Salons is.
Oh, well, there you go.
He's an adjunct, just like you.
All right.
Yeah.
Then I feel his pain. Film students are the worst. You're all terrible, Pilar. Quit wasting my time.
one of the criticisms.
Oh wait, no, but then
I know we're getting to that. Okay. One of the criticisms that you have brought up again and again with Salons is that you find him misanthropic.
Not entirely, and not in the knee-jerk way that a lot of people do. But
and you find him misanthropic to his own characters.
Often.
Toward his own characters.
Often, yes. Yeah. Not always.
And I see this other thing when I see his films. I see an empathy that's admittedly despairing, but...
I sense a disappointment with people who are not... being their, I hate to use this expression because it sounds like Oprah, not being their best selves. Right. And not in terms of the best that they can be, but in terms of the best they can behave toward others.
Yeah. We wind up with Wiener Dog in the hands of...
Ellen Burstyn.
Ellen Burstyn. A bitter, sad old woman. And she's being visited by...
Her granddaughter,
Zosia Mammoth. Who's useless.
Yes. And is there for a handout.
And is there for money. Right. So Ellen Burstyn has the dog, and she has renamed it...
Cancer.
Yes.
Just because.
Just because. One of the most moving sequences in the film is this part. Where Ellen Burstyn's childhood selves...
Mm.
A dozen of them.
Yeah, like parallel tracks of her life.
They all show up to talk to her.
Paths not taken.
And they say, what if you had learned kindness?
I'm you if...
Yeah.
I'm you if you had, you know...
If you had learned to forgive people.
Right.
If you had learned to love yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And... So what you have here is a film where everyone is running around in this circle of misery and they've got the dog with them.
Mm-hmm.
The dog can't help them.
No.
At all. And it's not like Balthazar helps people very much either. There's sort of like it's more of a spiritual, you know, what's the word? Benediction, is that what?
Yeah.
Is that, yeah.
But at least he's putting forth an effort.
Yeah.
Wiener Dog is only receptive.
Yeah.
And there's nothing to be given to Wiener Dog because these people have nothing to give.
Yeah. She cannot impart that grace to them.
Right. But like the giving tree, she sacrifices and sacrifices and sacrifices.
Yes. He also, like we said, he talked about Benji. Benji goes from owner to owner.
Mm-hmm.
In the first Benji film in 1974 or 5,
mm-hmm.
Benji goes from owner to owner. No one owns Benji.
Right.
He's the town mascot. He's just a mutt that runs around the town. And everybody calls him by different names.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Weirdly, the thing that the movie that Todd Solondz does not talk about is The Three Lives of Thomasina, which is sort of a bridge between Balthazar and Benji, where there are actual themes of atheism and reincarnation and... and spiritual enlightenment mm-hmm. in The Three Lives of Thomasina. It is a very strange movie.
Has he? I wonder if he's seen it. Like I
don't know. 1963 Disney live action film.
Did you Google to see if like anybody, any interviewers asked him about it?
I did not.
Okay.
I put it in my review though.
Right.
So, I love the connection between these two films.
This one, I think, you know, a lot of people are sort of lumping it in with, oh, it's another Salons movie where he's putting the screws to us.
Yeah.
This one felt less, how do I describe it? It felt less...
Less hopeless.
Less hopeless, yeah. Maybe less hectoring than some of his other movies.
I really still feel like Dark Horse is the most heartbroken and pleading, if you will, of his most recent of his more recent movies. I know you really dislike Dark Horse.
Yeah,
but I just tore me in half.
I that was one where I did feel like he was judging the characters. I put Thomasina Salons in Google, and the first thing that comes up is you.
Yeah.
So I guess no one else asked
for
that.
Well, hooray for me.
Aren't you insightful?
And being so great.
But no, I like this film. I think that it's it is more for me a movie about not somebody who hates humanity as much as somebody who is disappointed by humanity.
Right.
That we could be doing better and we aren't.
Right. There is
I will say this.
Yes.
A thing that gets on my nerves that I noticed is in this movie, the little kid in the first segment.
Tell me what you're going to say.
Talks like Heather Matarazzo.
Yes. In Woe Yes. Woe. Looks like her too.
He does that high pitched thing.
Yeah, I feel I think that's entirely intentional, because when the kid shows up and starts speaking, I just thought, "Oh, it's Boy Don Wiener."
It is Boy Don Wiener.
Yeah.
And again, it's that argument of, is he condescending or not? I kind of feel like he's making these characters talk like idiots in a way. And it's like, as much compassion as he has for Don Wiener and for Boy Don Wiener, they're also like, you can understand why the characters around them get annoyed with them very quickly.
They're children. Kids are dumb. Everybody knows that.
But
even kids know it on some level.
Okay, but like the kid in Happiness.
Any
doesn't.
Kids listening? I hate to break this to you kids who are listening. You are not as smart as you think you are. When you're grown up, you're going to be real smart. You're going to like run the country and build rockets and stuff. But right now, you're pretty dumb.
Yeah, you're just
that's why you should believe your parents when they tell you things. Unless your parents are totally gaslighting you, that's a problem. Like, don't, if you've got dog tooth parents, run away from home.
Your 20s will be spent realizing how dumb you were when you were a teenager, and your 30s will be spent realizing how dumb you were in your 20s.
Pretty much. That's life. Like, every decade that you grow, every 10 years that you live, you look back on the decade that before, and you think, oh man, what an idiot I was.
I feel like in my 30s, I was okay.
No, you were pretty dumb.
Probably. I mean, I wasn't as smart as I am now in my 40s. But, you know.
I look back on stuff I wrote back then. I'm embarrassed.
Oh, no, believe me.
Yeah.
My whole thing of like,
Not for the internet that just erases
my
stuff.
Whole, like, I wanted, you know, I was going to do that 10th anniversary Kindle for 101 Must See Movies. Like, yeah. Oh, no, I have to do a page one rewrite of this whole book because I'm mortified by everything in it.
Okay, so, we're not going to do any letters this week because this is going on a long time.
Yeah, but we're
going
to have tons in the one that posts.
How many
next
minutes
week.
Have we gone?
An hour 22.
Okay, then let's crank it out with the last two that we watched. We watched, well, I caught up on a film that you had already seen.
Yes.
1949's In the Good Old Summertime.
Right, which I had seen, well, I had seen it anyway, but I talked about it in my Christmas movie book because it is a remake of Shop Around the Corner. Which, strangely enough, it's a musical remake of Shop Around the Corner, not to be confused with She Loves Me, which is the stage musical remake of Shop Around the Corner that it's currently been revived on Broadway.
Also not to be confused with You've Got Mail, which is
correct.
The Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks
yes.
version.
And
of
they
that
trotted
story.
Meg Ryan out of the Tonys this year to introduce the number from She Loves Me.
Correct. So, In the Good Old Summertime is an incredibly boring film.
Woo! You would not imagine how charming and sparkling and witty and lovely Shop Around the Corner is.
Yeah.
It's like judging the women by the opposite sex.
Yeah.
In terms of remakes.
The movie called The Opposite Sex, which is a remake of The Women.
Right.
Yes. Just wanted to clarify
yes.
that.
No, thank you.
People who did not maybe know.
Yes. I was speaking in italics, couldn't you tell?
Yeah. It bums me out. This is part of my chronological Judy Garland career survey.
Right.
And any time that the music is not going and she's not there singing and knocking another one out of the park,
mm-hmm.
it is a slog.
Yeah, Van Johnson, not the most charismatic leading man.
No, and no, there's no indication that he and Judy Garland might ever want to be with each other. They don't even have
They don't have the good enemy chemistry.
Yeah, they don't even have good, you know, fiery hate
yeah.
for one another.
They're an annoyance to one another.
Yeah.
I suspect that they wanted to do another period movie on the heels of Meet Me in St. Louis.
Yes.
Which had been a big hit, and it was sort of Judy's, like, I'm an adult now movie.
They even give her another Christmas song to sing.
Yes.
In this film. It's not a good Christmas song.
It is not.
But I'll tell you what is the good song in this movie.
I don't care. I don't care.
Here's how you can say that you've seen everything you need to see in the film in the good old summertime. Go to YouTube. Type in Judy Garland.
I don't care.
Then type in I don't care. Then watch her sing I don't care with its attendant choreography.
Yes.
And arm motions. What planet was she on that day that she got beamed into the set of this film and then beamed back out of? Because that number is one of the highlights of her entire film career, as far as I'm concerned, in one of the worst films of her career.
Right. Well, I mean, maybe it was late in the game and she was like, I gotta inject some life into this turkey. actually, there are two things you have to see in this movie. The other one is go to YouTube and look for the very ending of In the Good Old Summertime.
Oh, yeah,
so that you can see the cameo by Baby Liza Minnelli.
Baby Liza.
As Dave pointed out, how were they married for a year and have a four-year-old? But yeah, Baby Liza Minnelli made her screen debut as the resultant child of Van Johnson and Judy Garland.
Judy's handing her to Van Johnson, and Liza's like, eh. Who's this?
Please. It was the first of many gay men to whom Liza would become close. Well, the second after Vincent Minnelli, of course.
Right, after her own father.
Father, yes. Yeah.
Okay, and then we watched 1931's
Reducing. I love the word reducing. It's a word that people use. They used to say for like diet and exercise.
Are
or
you
whatever.
Dieting? Yes, I've been reducing.
It's like when people would call psychiatrists alienists or refer to gays as inverts. It's like an old school term that nobody uses anymore. So yeah, there's a movie called Reducing, featuring the very popular and successful comedy team of Marie Dressler and Polly Moran.
Yes.
And it's Marie Dressler month at TCM.
Yes.
I think I'd only seen her in Dinner at Eight, where she has some great one-liners.
Yes.
I know she was in Anna Christie with Garbo, and I need to see that movie. But in this one, Moran...
Made when she was 60, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Moran and Dressler play sisters. Dressler and her family travel from South Bend, Indiana, to New York City, where the widowed Moran runs a popular reducing salon. And...
full of, like... machines with belts and
like mud baths and steam cabinets and you know lots of vintage kind of torture devices for weight loss, and they both have attractive ingenue daughters played by Anita Page and I forget who, and they become rivals over this rich guy, and the reducing kind of gets thrown out of the movie about halfway through
because they're done.
Yeah, Moran and Dressler are falling out. Dressler moves out, and then her daughter gets involved with this guy, and blah 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 blah. Anyway, for the first half though, it's pretty hilarious, and there's some really good slapstick with the reducing, and with like there's a scene of Marie Dressler buying train tickets. That is very funny.
Yeah.
That involves like a coin purse that she puts in her bra that falls south. It's a pre-code movie, but it's pretty tame. I mean,
it's very tame.
There's an implication that somebody's got to get married because they're knocked up, but they talk around it so much that like you could completely miss it if you weren't paying attention.
It's just one of those great old movies from the early 30s, which is now 85 years ago.
Yes.
Where the phone numbers are, Metropolitan 4579.
Yes, exactly.
People are having,
spittoons. There are spittoons in this.
I'm sorry.
Cuspidors.
Cuspidors. People are yelling about cuspidors.
Yes.
And my favorite line in the film is they're talking about whether you should marry a smart man or not. And Marie Dressler says, A man who's a little dumb is more restful. And the whole thing is about 68 minutes long. It's not, it's not much of anything, but it's a strange little fun thing to look at.
Yeah, it's an entertaining little early talkie. I think if you get the Watch TCM app, it's on there and you can watch it.
Yeah. Okay, we're done.
All right, what's your DVD pick this week?
Oh, my DVD pick this week.
Mm. Do you want to just make it Ozard Balthazar and make them too?
Is that available on Criterion still?
I believe so.
I've made that my DVD.
You're right. Yeah, you have. Yeah.
In the past.
A Winding Refn movie, perhaps, or a Todd Solondz movie. Do you want to recommend Dark Horse?
I do like Dark Horse.
Okay.
Yeah, Dark Horse. Watch Dark Horse. It's so sad. So very sad, and you know how much I like that. I know some of you do, too.
I was trying to think about, like, model movies after seeing The Neon Demon, and so as part of the William Klein Eclipse box set, my recommendation this week is Who Are You, Pauly Magoo? Yeah. A very stylish and funny satire of the modeling world.
That's
circa
a wild
1968,
movie.
Directed by William Klein. The movie that got him fired from Vogue, because there's a character in the film that is definitely supposed to be Deanna Vreeland.
Oh, yeah.
And she were not amused.
Like the Gorgon Deanna Vreeland. Yeah.
The Anna Wintour Deanna Vreeland. All right, so okay, if we're not going to do letters, then I guess we can wrap this baby up.
We're going to do letters
next time.
For the next, yes, like, that's...
For the episode that airs while I'm out of town.
Space to fill.
So, hey, Outfest Los Angeles is coming up. If you are in the Southern California area, go to outfest.org and check out the schedule. There's a lot of really great stuff we're doing, including a preview of the new Ghostbusters movie. We're paying tribute to James Franco with the screaming of King Cobra. And, my personal pick, I want to say, if you can, go see a movie called Baby Bump. I saw it at Venice last year. It's wild and nuts and certain to be talked about. And I can't recommend it enough. And stick around after that is Bad Movie Night, hosted by Drew Droege and Dave Holmes, with several female comedians joining them. We're doing a lesbian film this year.
Do you know their names yet?
No, but the ones that they're talking to are really good ones, so okay. It's going to be exciting. So those are both screening on Thursday, the 14th of July at Red Cat, but there's a whole 10 days worth of stuff. So go to outfest.org and check all that out. Also, go to ChristyLemire.com, listen to the B-Movies podcast and Canceled Too Soon, featuring Bibbs and Whitney, The Schmoes Know, The Sewers of Paris, The Joel Ryan Thing, The Comics Canon, The Bret Easton Ellis podcast, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. Thank you, Blue, for our great theme music. Go to Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. You can stream the show for free at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. You can subscribe for free at iTunes. And hey, leave us a review, please. It totally helps. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions or comments. We will be catching up on letters on next week's episode. And of course, if you haven't already, go join our club, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
$4 per month. It's so cheap.
And more if you want more, but we start at 4. Anyway.
That's a good ride.
Thank you. Yes, yeah. I just came up with that. Yeah. All right. Anyway, thanks for joining us. Long episode this week, but we hope you had a good drive to enjoy it on. And we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.